Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. To learn more about Allowed and how you can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The program you're about to hear from the Allowed Archives was produced in 2007. Now, please welcome Tim Rutan. Thank you.
It's my, first of all, thank you. Thank you all for coming. And I could see that many of you made a great effort to get here, and it's very much appreciated. It's my great pleasure to introduce to you my great friend and longtime conversational adversary, Christopher Hitchens, for several reasons, because I think Christopher's role as probably the greatest literary journalist of our generation, of my generation, is widely misunderstood. Christopher is often described as contrarian, by which I take, the meaning I take from that is someone who continually takes an oppositional position. It isn't really true. Christopher Hitchens has stood for things, and he has maintained them, things like free expression, things like open inquiry, things like humane and decent societies. He stood for those things when other people were willing to let them go by the boards. I guess that makes him a contrarian, but I think of him more as he puts it, as somebody who comes from the other island, whose family did at least. To me, he's a rooted man. He's rooted in great things, things of great value, and we're going to talk about some of them tonight. We're going to disagree about some of them, and then we'll hear from you. So I hope you'll join me in welcoming Christopher Hitchens here to Los Angeles.
We got that bit right.
Did indeed.
They think it's Lucozade or something. Should I start? Should I respond?
Well, yes, please do.
Well, that was extremely handsome of you, I must say. And I want to tell the people who've been good enough to come tonight, thank you very much, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, comrades, friends. I see nervous reluctance to applaud at any... that I've been up and down the country with this book, and I've been debating with Baptists in North Carolina and rabbis in Coral Gables and Al Sharpton in New York and so on. But this is actually the only evening that I've booked on this trip that, on which I feel nervous at all. And that's because Mr. Rutan here, with whom, as he says, I've been discussing for many years, really does know what he's talking about. When it's come to religion, and that can't be said for many of the ministers. And if I wanted to ask anyone, I have sometimes had to ask, what exactly is the difference between a Melkite Greek Catholic and a Greek Orthodox and a Maronite in Lebanon? There's only one person I would know to call who would know the answer to this. And that's why it's very handsome of Tim to agree to do this, because... not to make this too furry between us, not to make it too intimate or too warm or friendly. I would like, on both our behalves, to dispel that if I can right now. The critical thing is this. What is most important to him is most hateful to me. And we're here to prove that friendship is possible under those conditions. But that thought should not at all inhibit anyone, and hope won't inhibit him, from Well, I think the expression may be bringing it on. He minds about this a lot. It's a great deal to him. And he's proved it in innumerable ways, not just by his study of it, but by his devotion to it. And I have announced it to be public enemy number one. So if this all works this evening, it'll be a tribute to civilized discourse, if you insist. Okay. Thus my opening statement.
Disarming and provocative.
Oh, sweet.
Let's speak by the book that we're ruined, right? This is the book. Christopher, I'm going to read a passage to you here, and just so we can get the flavor of the argument here, and then we'll go to the substance. But if I may, you write here about how you tolerate religious expression on the parts of your friends.
Not tolerate, do we?
Well, indulge, as you say.
Better, yeah.
Indulgence, yes, is the word you use. And he says, you write, there is a real and serious difference between me and my religious friends. And the real and serious friends are sufficiently honest to admit it. I would be quite content to go to their children's bar mitzvahs, to marvel at their Gothic cathedrals, to respect their belief in the Quran, that the Quran was dictated, though exclusively in Arabic, to an illiterate prophet, or to interest myself in Wicca and Hindu and Jain consolations. And as it happens, I will continue to do this without insisting on the polite reciprocal condition, which is that they, in turn, leave me alone. Right? Fair enough. But this religion is ultimately incapable of doing. As I write these words, and as you read them, and as you listen to them, people of faith are in their different ways planning your and my destruction and the destruction of all the hard-won human attainments that I have touched upon. Religion poisons everything. So religion is ultimately incapable of leaving people alone. Is that correct?
Yes, I think it is because why not start with the benign? This isn't going to go on for too long, by the way, this benign version of our disagreement, but
right.
Why not continue with it for a little bit? I mean, for example, you, as a very, very serious Roman Catholic, must look at me and think, if you're true to your faith, I can't watch this go on any longer. I don't want Christopher to go to hell. It's not right to do it. I have a responsibility to prevent him, to exert my best efforts to stop this from happening. I can see him doing it. It's like watching a friend become a hopeless alcoholic or a drug addict or a serial killer. I must intervene. I may not watch this. I must do my best. And I know that you ought to be thinking that, and it makes me very nervous. Just as I was debating with a Calvinist in Georgia the other day, I said, well, look, do you, since you say you're a Baptist, do you affirm John Calvin's teachings on hell and predestination, or do you not? And if you do not, because I know Southern hospitality often inhibits people from telling guests that they go to hell on the first night of their stay in their stay. Trying to make it easy for him.
Not if you're Catholic.
But if you don't think so, could I know by on what authority you don't do this? Mm-hmm. On what authority do you disagree, as well as on what authority you do? So, when, for example, now moving to the vulgar side of your church, the only Catholic who almost every secular person I know admires or used to admire. Mother Teresa, so-called Mother Teresa of Calcutta, journeys to the country that I know matters most to you, Ireland, to say, no one in Ireland should be allowed to be divorced. I've arrived in Dublin, a town of which I know nothing, capital of a country about which I know nothing, to support the view of those who say that there can be no change in the Irish Constitution. Sorry, the Irish Constitution. Which forbids divorce. We don't just forbid it for Catholics. We forbid it for everybody. and is praised by everyone. Finally, Mother Teresa's come to aid us in the argument. Right. And while she's there, takes the opportunity to say that not only should Irish people not be allowed abortions, but nor should they be allowed contraception. She's not saying, I have a great relationship with Jesus, and I have a wonderful church and a wonderful faith, and it makes me happy. She's saying, it better make you happy too, because whether you agree with it or not, we're going to impose it on you. Now, that distinction must clearly be apparent to everybody here. The same is true of our Muslim brothers and sisters. They say, you may not know it yet, but our prophet had the last revelation, the only one.
The final one. There's always a final revelation.
Your revelations were not bad. We agree with you about the virgin birth. We agree with you about various of the more horrible Mosaic prohibitions. You notice that Islam plagiarizes from Judaism and Christianity only the most horrible bits and leaves out the Greek stuff. It does, too. But they do all that. They say, well, we even think you're people of the book. They tolerate you, in other words. They say, we tolerate you. I'm not going to be tolerated by these people. They say, but we've got something last and final, ultimate. You only need this one book. If you only get round to believing it, you would be happy. But we can't be happy until you do. Now, I'm very sorry. I'm extremely sorry to say this, and I'll put it as mildly as I can, but I decline to be spoken to in that tone of voice by anybody. I hope that's plain.
Fair enough.
I hope that's absolutely plain. I won't be talked to like that. I'm not going to be tolerated by the admirers of an illiterate Middle Eastern peasantry.
No. No, I see that, you know...
I think we'd be better off outgrowing it.
We've all, you know, this is also a bit of, if I may say, the method of this book, which I enjoy immensely, by the way. You know, I do agree with Shalom Aleichem that there, in the shtetl, there were only two people who were really serious about God. One was the rabbi, and the other was the village atheist. Everybody else was just sort of going along. Now,
I have to do this now you've done
it. Go right ahead.
The third was the guy, it's mentioned in a great story by Irving Howe, which I think he borrowed from Isaac Singer, the man who stands on the wall of the shtetl, I think it's the town of Helm. And when the visitors come, he's always standing on the city wall looking out over the plains. And they ask him, well, what are you doing there, just standing there? And he said, no, I'm not just standing here. They pay me to stand here. Well, what do they pay you to do, standing there? Well, they pay me to watch out for the Messiah and to tell and ring this bell when he's coming. And they say, so what's it like? He said, well, steady work.
That's true enough. That's true enough.
It's man-made, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes. And constructed in much the same clever way that this argument is constructed, because we've slid from the debatable point to the inarguable ones. But I want to circle back to that debatable point, because we have experience to draw on. You and I have been friends for how many years?
Well, I remember very well, I remember very distinctly when I first met you, which would have to be 83.
83.
So we're getting on for a quarter of a century.
Or a quarter of a century.
Of doing this.
And we even did a film
together
on religion.
Mr. Rutten and I circled Los Angeles interviewing everyone from Lubavitcher rabbis to New Age mavens to Wiccans and Satanists.
And the people who worship the atomic bomb. Remember them?
Yes. They were the followers
of a deranged Polish countess.
I remember the bomb worshippers, but then eschatology is one of my big worries, especially now, because all religion, in a sense, has to hope for the end of days.
Right.
Does hope for it.
But Christopher...
secretly or openly, wants this to be over. It's one of the things I don't like, I have to say.
Well, of course, yeah. But
they can. I don't mind if they go, but I don't want them taking me with them. Rapture yourself, big boy.
But Christopher, in all this time, have I ever made a single proselytizing remark to you?
No, you have not. But and it wouldn't be your style. But that's why I took you up, perhaps preemptively, on your very serious and devout Catholicism. In that, I think it could perhaps only have been good manners. No, I don't mean to mock. I don't mean to say anything.
What about respect for another person's conscience?
Indeed, but you ought to have said to me, "Look, Christopher." At least within what I understand to be your own lights, and you could you could very well contradict me now, and I'd have to accept your negation, but it seems to me, from what I've read of your doctrine, that you ought not to be watching me without trying to save me. A word from you would have impressed me, by the way, if you'd said, look, Christopher, that was fun. We had a great evening.
Mm.
Most of our friends are secularists.
Mm.
We all know the jokes that we can make. But do you mind if I just detain you for a minute before you go home? Are you sure? Are you sure I can't help you to save yourself?
But that would be profoundly disrespectful.
Someone might
ask you a question and you would be available in response. But I think this undercuts this notion that and it's one of the threads that runs through this book is the necessity of making valid arguments in this absolutist way. And I wonder, is it necessary to state these propositions quite so absolutely to find any use in them? To say that some forms of religious expression are destructive just in the same way. I mean, look, there are some religious systems and sets of religious beliefs, like some people, who are no damn good. But that's not the tenor of the argument you've advanced here.
No. I mean, I'm only a poorly evolved mammal, half a chromosome away from a chimpanzee.
Or the pig, as you point out.
Or indeed, and able to take a heart valve from a pig, and may possibly soon be in need of same. Or a skin graft, which would negate quite a lot of religion right there, by the way.
Mm.
Kosher I'm not, okay? And I think religion shows every sign of having been invented by a species that is half a chromosome away from a chimpanzee. But I still take what the religious believe to be, in that sense, morally serious. And I can't write a book for everybody I meet, which I discovered on this tour I would essentially have had to do. They say, listen, I don't believe in the virgin birth, I don't believe in the rapture, I don't believe in predestination and hell, and so people who've said up till then that they're Catholics, Calvinists, Muslims, they say, well, that's what your texts say, that's all I can write about.
Mm.
If you're all going to take it a la carte and decide which bit you believe, I still want to know on which authority you don't believe it. Now, you're interviewing me, as it were.
Yes.
But so I shouldn't return the question to
you. Oh, please go right ahead.
If you do not believe that Jesus was born of a virgin, had God for his father, went through unbelievable suffering to be the vicarious recipient of your sin, your guilt, take it away from you, didn't in fact die but rose again, and will come again to judge the quick and the dead, if you don't believe any of that,
the Nicene Creed,
you're not really a Catholic, seems to me.
This is absolutely true.
And since I find great difficulty in believing that someone like you does really believe this, I don't know what book I should have written to unpersuade you of something that you can't quite apparently get your mind to assimilate.
Well, yes, what I'm getting
but
at,
I would
though,
say that your doubt is a point for me rather than a point against.
No, I would say that one of the deficiencies in this immensely thought-provoking book is that it does not allow for the progress of religious institutions along with other human ones. And one thing that anyone who claims to be a religious believer today must have forsworn, not only in their in a formal way, but I think in their hearts, is any notion of coercion, because religious coercion has undoubtedly proven to be something evil. And that brings me to, if I may, since I am the interviewer.
Absolutely.
The point of privilege here. There's a wonderful, wonderful argument that you raise at the end of the book that you call your anticipated objection, where you go to the question of the terrible killer societies of the 20th century.
Yes.
Your own experience with some of them. And you lay out a series of arguments about the problem here is that if we look back across this terrible century that we've just completed, murder occurred on an unimagined and frankly still unimaginable scale. And it was done primarily by societies which were formally atheist societies. Societies where atheism, which you advance here as this, you know, as not the necessary good, the unavoidable good, that was the official orthodoxy. Stalin did not act in the name of Russian orthodoxy. Hitler did not act in the name of Christianity. Mao did not act in the name of Confucianism. North Korea, which you know, as you say, you still cannot remember without a shudder, is certainly not a religious state. It is an officially atheist state. So you make an argument about this, in which you say that or suggest at least that these states were murderous because their leaders were acting on remnant religious impulses or appropriations of religious impulses. Is that really your position?
Yes, it is. I mean,
is that a fair summary of?
Yeah, no, it is also, by the way, a very good summary of my case. Though, just to tease people and make them buy the book, where I have a whole chapter on this, available fine bookstores everywhere. And everything.
It's a very fine chapter.
And I've now, because of course this question comes up at every stop, I would now be able to write that chapter. That's the great thing about writing a book, by the way. You come into contact with the people and the arguments you should have met before you wrote it. But that's a common experience of authorship, if that's not too postmodern an observation. I was still hue to what I say in it. It's not possible to say of fascism, which is the movement that invents the term totalitarian, that it's secular. It's just not possible to say so. I mean, of Mussolini, Franco, Salazar, the Ustasha, you know this very well because your church has been
Slovakia.
Slovakia, where the head of the Nazi puppet state was actually a man in holy orders.
That's right, Tiso.
Your father, your holy father and your church has been through agony can't still seem to apologize quite in the right tone about that fact and its implications. So that, I think, excuses the secularist, not for everything, but doesn't implicate them. Of German National Socialism.
Wait a minute. You can't think of fascism as having a religious base. It was tolerated by religious conservatives and reactionaries in those societies, but certainly not. Ooh. It was certainly not. I mean, in order, for example, for fascism to take hold in Bavaria, I mean, you know, Pius XII had to gut the Catholic.
Oh, an account of Bavaria.
Yeah, all right, go ahead.
Because we haven't moved, I mean, the German National Socialism, but to be willing to concede, as at least the Church has been, that in Spain and Portugal and Italy and so on, it was essentially empowered by a concordate with the Vatican, I think you would not deny. German National Socialism is a somewhat different thing, because though it draws upon Protestant as well as Catholic Christianity and anti-communism, and I think above all, anti-Semitism, and prayers were said, it is a fact, by the bishops of Germany every year in April on Hitler's birthday, on the instruction of the Vatican. You can't say that that's a Catholic movement because they wanted to replace Christianity with German paganism and Nordic myths combined with ethnic blood legends and all kinds of ghastly nonsense. But still, you can't call that secular, by the way. It's still mythology and blood worship. And Odin is no better than any of these other imaginary figures. But it had a hatred for Christianity, I will say that. And it did also arouse some, which it didn't elsewhere so much, some very, very brave and distinguished and famous Christian opponents who paid for it with their lives and seem to have been glad to do so.
Since we're going
to
single out Pius XII for his dereliction, we'd probably have to cite Pius XI for Mitbrunner Sonnigan.
Yeah, but it's kind of amazing that the anti-Nazi Pope dies in 1939 and the pro-Nazi Pope is appointed by God in 1940. That seems like a lot to expect of the Vicar of Christ. I mean, it's a lot to believe if you are a Catholic. And of the, so it's not, I would not say National Socialism was secular in any sense at all, let alone atheist. And then remember of the third pillar of the Axis powers, the terrifying dictatorship of Hirohito. It's held in power by two considerations. One, its leader is not godly, but is a god.
Is himself a god, yes.
And its ideology is Zen Buddhism, which is the training of its soldiers.
I saw Shinto, not Zen.
No, Zen too. Brian Victoria's book, which I mentioned in my book, Zen at War, absolutely confirms it. Zen discipline was the order of the day in the Japanese Imperial Army. Shinto too, I think it's actually more Shinto that trained the kamikaze idea, but Zen as well. The leader is himself a god. That's not a secular state by any means. By the way, I don't know if this is true because I haven't checked, but it comes from a good source. Some of you may know Michael Krasny, who does this brilliant show and interviewed me the other day in San Francisco, home of the American Buddhist. Said, had I followed the genocide trials in Cambodia? And I said, you know what? I've been busy. I haven't been doing this. I probably should have done. I used to. Civil society has recovered in Cambodia to the extent that it looks as if the Khmer Rouge criminals are going to be tried for genocide now.
Right.
The Buddhist party in Cambodia doesn't want it. It says, why do this? All those people who were killed had committed sins in previous lives. This is a mental surrender, and a moral one too. This kind of contemplative nonsense, turn off the mind and you'll have bliss, has ghastly consequences. The sleep of reason brings forth monsters. That's Buddhism. That's Buddhism, the resort that everyone goes to when they've exhausted monotheism.
Right. I think it's a fair point. It's a fair point.
But well, I haven't got to Stalin yet, by the way.
Wait a minute. It leaves aside the fact that the killer, upon whom they're commenting or making this moral surrender, was in fact an atheist, no?
Well, the name of the... You mean in Cambodia?
I mean Pol Pot, yes.
Yeah. Well, in Cambodia, all I know, and I know this much, is that the ruling power, the mysterious, ultimate, absolute, was called the Angkor, which is a reference back to Angkor Wat and the ancient Buddhist mysterious dictatorship that existed in the Stone Age of Indochina. Right. And you'll find, if you look into it, that the current extremely repellent dictatorship in Burma is also the great builder of Buddhist temples and the great mass producer of Buddhist statues and rules in the name of Buddhism, as did Lon Nol's original army in Cambodia that was the agent of the United States invasion of the country and defender and profiteer from it. So I'm not so sure that these... I'm not so sure that if you change your climate from east to west that you escape human irrationality or servility. It seems to me that it follows you wherever you go as long as you're willing to surrender your mind and to put your trust in faith. I think the outcomes there are always the same. Sleep of reason will bring forth monsters. I may not know much, but I think I know that much.
I think that's quite correct, but it doesn't get around the fact that Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge were an officially atheist party.
Well, I'm not sure you see if they were. I think they had Buddhist, a sort of ancient ethnic, pseudo-confessional, mystical nationalism to them. And I haven't answered your question about Stalin yet, and because I've babbled
please.
A bit, I ought to. I don't want anyone to think I've dodged it. Well, put it like this, with communism, which is unlike fascism and National Socialism, officially materialistic. You're Joseph Stalin. It's 1917 in Russia. Millions of Russians have been told for hundreds of years that the head of the Russian government is something more than a human being. Not a god. It's not as bad as Japan. And not quite a pope either, but he's the Tsar is the head of the Russian Orthodox Church. He stands between heaven and earth. A bit more like the Middle Kingdom. Servility and credulity is en masse inculcated right across the country. Millions of people know no better. If you're Joseph Stalin, who, by the way, this is an opportunist point of mine, but I have to mention it, was a longtime seminary student, had rehearsed to be a priest. You shouldn't be.
Was he not expelled?
I think he may have just cleared out, but
I think he was expelled.
But you shouldn't be, if you're Joseph Stalin, you shouldn't be in the dictatorship business if you can't exploit a great pool of credulity and servility like that. There you have it. It's waiting. All you need to do is say on the news are. And what happens? A new inquisition, a heresy hunt, show trials. The traitors are among us. The heretics are here, trying to poison the wells. Miracles. Lysenko, our great new biologist, has shown how we can grow 25-foot-wide tomatoes that will feed an entire family, stachanovite saints. The entire thing is completely replicated and collapses, as the Inquisition did.
Stalin is murderous because he's an imperfect
Well, it's a replication. It's a surrogate for the same thing. It's a replication of a counterfeit, or if you like, a true bill copy of the same thing. But here's what you'd need to have a level playing field between your point and mine. You'd need to find a society hitherto pious and devout and organic and stable. That adopted the views of, and Inkalk tried to teach its children the principles of Lucretius, Epicurus, Spinoza, Galileo, Einstein, Thomas Jefferson, Thomas Paine, Bertrand Russell, the greatest atheist of his day, and the first person to work out that Lenin was a new god, by the way, to adopt those teachings, and then to see if that society fell into famine, war, tyranny, torture, gulag, and so on. That would be the fair test, and that test is yet to come. But I believe myself that we can recover the lost connection, the one that monotheism severed between Athens and Jerusalem. And we could get back a world where philosophy was valued. The beauty of science was considered worth studying, worth revering even. Where literature would be the key to the study of ethics and morality. And if you wanted the transcendent, you'd have love and sex and music. And you wouldn't need any supernatural permission for any of this nonsense. I think I miss it terribly. I feel as if something was torn away from me before I was born by the loss of that. But we're smart enough to get it back. If only we will leave behind the hideous nonsense of the holy books and the vile preachments of those who want the world to come to an end.
Well, I'm for that. I'm for that.
Good.
Let's see. On the other hand, has there been such a place?
Well,
I mean, I hate to sound like I'm speaking on behalf of our fallen nature, but has there been such a place?
Well, the country I happen to be, may I use an expression?
Are we going to get Andalusian Spain now?
May I just say something that doesn't seem too populist, but an expression I've been waiting for a long time to employ. Not to you so much, but to the audience, my fellow Americans. I've been wanting it a long time to say this. I took my oath of citizenship last month on the 13th of April, which is my birthday and also Mr. Jefferson's birthday. I'm his biographer at his memorial in Washington, D.C. by the Tidal Basin, just before the cherry blossoms were blown away by the next breeze. And I was able to take my oath and say that I specifically wanted to take it to the only constitution ever in human history that doesn't mention God, except, and doesn't mention religion, except to separate it from politics.
Right.
And to the preamble to the Declaration, which mentions only a creator but no intervening God, no personal God, no intervening one. And to say how extraordinary it is that most Americans, born to this right and this beauty, don't appreciate it because it comes to them as a birthright. and the Virginia Statute on Religious Freedom, the basis of our fantastic First Amendment, means a huge amount to me. No tithe can be paid by any American to any church. The government has no right to tell anyone how or where or in which way to worship at all. And that in the response to the petitioners of Danbury, Connecticut, the president wrote back to them and said, there will be always a wall of separation to protect your rights and your freedoms. So I have a new slogan. Mr. Jefferson, build up that wall.
But
I hope to be joined in this slogan.
Yes. Well, actually, I join you in that slogan because I think one of the curious things about and remarkable things about Jefferson's genius and one of its unintended consequences is that religion as in all its variations has flourished behind that wall here in the United States as it has nowhere else. That religion severed from state support and from the notion of the official church has flourished here.
Tocqueville was right, as are you. Yeah. If it's a voluntary association, it can be very pluralistic. After all, do you know, so you don't you say? Because you know, but I wonder if anyone here knows. Who were the Baptists of Danbury, Connecticut, writing about to the president? Who were they afraid of? Who did they think was going to persecute them? Why did they want a wall? The Congregationalists of Danbury, Connecticut.
Congregation.
That's who they were afraid of.
Vicious bands of roving congregations.
Who was killing the Quakers in Pennsylvania? The Presbyterians of Pennsylvania. In Maryland, at the time of before the Constitutional Convention, you could only be in office if you were a Catholic. In New York, you couldn't be in office if you were a Catholic. Right?
Yeah, was it in Georgia,
you had to say you were a Protestant, whatever that meant. In Rhode Island, you could not be a Jew and hold office. In Connecticut, you could be a Jew and hold office, but you couldn't be a Catholic and hold office. It was going to be religious chaos on the European scale. Unbelievably, we had the Philadelphia Enlightenment that said, no, we don't have to go through this again. The United States will be different about this. We won't allow it. There will be no such test. There will be no such... People should know only how lucky they are. I think it's of the absolutely first importance to defend it.
Yeah, Christopher, let me ask you this, in all seriousness. This is a profoundly post 9/11 book.
Yes.
You wrote this book, I think, because of what occurred on 9/11 and because of the struggle that we now confront with fundamentalist jihadist Islam, or if you've called it, Islamofascism.
Yes.
Okay. Is it possible that in making the argument there and in trying and in giving that argument as much breadth as possible, you've overlooked the virtues of religious pluralism in a country that enforces, albeit imperfectly and with continual struggle, separation of church and state? It's as if this book, for all of your admiration of Jefferson, sometimes behaves as if that wall did not exist here, that it had never been made to work anywhere. Is it all conceivable?
There is a problem with having said, as I did, that religious pluralism is a great thing in itself and can only be guaranteed by a secular state. The point the religious
Absolutely.
Just keep on not getting. You see, if only the state was all Baptist, we'd be fine. they want to teach creation in school. We say, all right, I'll teach you the Hindu creation myth to your children. And now are you happy? No, I'm sure not. I say, well, you asked for it. You know, now you've got it. There is a problem of that kind, which is reverse ecumenicism. I'll tell you what I mean by that, apparently arcane statement. I'm sure everyone here remembers the assault on the tiny European democracy of Denmark last year.
Mm.
Why was the Danish economy subjected to a campaign of international sabotage backed by not just movements but states? Why were its embassies burned down in countries where demonstrations are not normally allowed? Why was all this? Because its prime minister could not be forced or persuaded to censor cartoons in the afternoon press in Copenhagen because it's against Danish law for him to do this. Right? So, you and I are members of this great profession. Mm-hmm. Did the Los Angeles Times publish those cartoons?
No, it didn't. But I wrote a column in the Los Angeles Times that began, "The editor of the Los Angeles Times will not allow you to see these cartoons."
Voila.
And went on to argue that it was a great breach of faith with the people of Denmark and with Danish democracy. And that column appeared as one of two I did about this and about the cowardly surrender.
It was one of about five that did, and I remember them. I remember it vividly because you and I were in such a small minority. Mm-hmm. In a media totally dominated now by image, totally dominated by images, It was not considered appropriate to tell the American public, here's a story that's all about the fight over some pictures, but we're not going to show you what the pictures are.
Listen, as a religious believer myself, I'm totally unaffected by these things.
Wait, it's because it's not you I'm trying to persuade. Yeah. That's the main point. The image-dominated press said, no, we're not going to show you. Neither out of solidarity with our Danish colleagues, which would be a good point, or just to show you what the fuss is about. No, they wouldn't. That's either out of fear of the religious, or it's out of fear of offending them, which comes to more or less the same thing. It's blackmail. In the United States of America, in 2006, there wasn't a single member of our profession in a position to make a decision who would stand up for one day to outright blackmail. And people say to me, why do you keep mentioning the extremists? I say, because the extremists are the tail that wag the whole dog. And my profession proves it, and your culture proves it, and you were humiliated by this. And it gets worse. Because I write for a very small atheist magazine called Free Inquiry, and published out of Amherst, Massachusetts, which did publish the cartoons. Say, it's a responsibility. First, solidarity with the Danes. Second, people should see what the fuss is about. Hmm. Borders Books takes our magazine off the rack. So you can't sell your magazine now. I've refused to read or speak in a Borders bookstore ever since. Least I could do. Unless they really, really, really offer me a lot of money. And a complete capitulation, a total capitulation. And people say, why do I focus on the extremists? Because the extremists have the initiative and because, I haven't started yet, who condemned what? I remind you, individual Scandinavians were murdered in everywhere from Afghanistan to Nigeria by this historical prearranged campaign. 21 ambassadors from so-called Muslim states. How dare they call themselves Muslim? In what sense is Egypt a Muslim country? You can't denominate a country as religious. Waited upon His Holiness the Pope.
Well, and in fact, two leading Egyptian newspapers, as I pointed out in my column, did run the cartoons.
They're braver than the American papers. Yeah. But His Holiness the Pope condemned what? The cartoons. Mm. The State Department condemned the cartoons, not the violence, not the campaign of intimidation. The Archbishop of Canterbury condemned the cartoons. Every church I know of condemned the blasphemy of the cartoons, not the campaign of murder and sabotage and intimidation. In other words, ladies and gentlemen, the barbarians are not at the gate. They're not at the gate. They're well inside. And who held open the door for them? The other religious did. Same with Salman Rushdie. When the Ayatollah Khomeini offered money publicly in his own name, without shame, for suborning of murder of a novelist who wasn't an Iranian, who lived in England. A pretty radical attack on what we think we live by, what our constitution stands for, what Mr. Jefferson, Mr. Paine thought it was worth fighting for. The Cardinal Archbishop of New York, the Chief Rabbi of Israel, His Holiness the Pope, the Archbishop of Canterbury, all condemned what? The novel, the author, for blasphemy. Now get used to this because you may be living in the last few years where you can complain about it. Because the religious really mean this, you know. They are not just joking. They really mean to abolish everything you care about. And they want to take away everything you love and to destroy everything you have and to replace it with a Stone Age ideology derived from the desert of Palestine in a very bad time in human history. Now, and just because they were there first, They think they own everything. They think they have the right to tell you what you can think, who you can sleep with, what you can eat, what you can read. And they claim the right to make you afraid, even to read, in the United States of America this year. So I don't want to hear from anybody that my book says, well, don't judge religion by its extremes, okay? Don't do that.
Well, we would distinguish, say, the cowardice of the Archbishop of Canterbury from the murderous violence of, say, Amin Zawahiri. Would that be a fair distinction?
No, because the Archbishop has prearranged his capitulation to them. He thinks they're people of faith. The Archbishop of Canterbury says, I don't care if there are schools in England, this is happening now, that are run by Zawahiri supporters. I don't mind it, as long as you allow special schools for Christians and Jews, and also special different schools for Protestants and Catholics. Mm. If you allow faith schools, we'll allow them to have their faith schools. Cultural suicide. Cultural suicide. Don't let it happen to you. Don't let it happen where you live. Look how wonderfully it worked. You know it very well, what happened in Northern Ireland when it was allowed to segregate Protestant and Catholic schools. After all, they have different faiths. Oh, they do? I thought they were both Christian. I can't arbitrate this. No, they should have separate schools. They should never meet, never intermarry, never socialize. Beautifully that worked out.
And now
let's have it for Jews and Muslims too on the mainland. Let them all lie to their children. Let them all give their special myth. Let them all say to them that they're different. Let them not tell them that they're members of a civil society or a country or a nation. Let them denominate themselves by faith. Can't wait to see what happens. I think I know what's coming. I don't want my beloved country of birth to be turned into some fucking Lebanon by people of faith. I don't want it. I'm going to fight it too. And you should get ready to fight it when they try it in your case. Don't allow this. Putting the word faith in front of something is no excuse for barbarism and cruelty and ignorance and stupidity. Just as putting the word reverend in front of a stupid name like Falwell or Sharpton doesn't mean you should be on MSNBC. Learn to resist it because you're going to need to.
Well, Christopher, this is about you. I'm right there resisting it with you as a...
And the Archbishop of Canterbury.
Of the values of the, I learned in Catholic school.
Hmm?
I'll be there with you resisting it because of the values I learned in Catholic school.
You will and you should because, after all, the Archbishop of Canterbury, until... mentioned as a bland, a benign
bloody
figure,
prod, yes,
who looks in his own person at present, this Welsh comedian, Rowan Williams, looks exactly like a sheep. He's supposed to look like a shepherd, but he looks like a sheep instead. One of my earliest uneases, by the way, was, why do I have to call myself a lamb the entire time? I'm not a sheep. I don't want to be called a sheep. Why do they call me a member of a flock?
Sure.
Isn't that kind of a tip-off? But anyway, this sheep-faced figure would, until 70 years ago, would have said that a member of your church could not serve in Parliament,
right?
Could not be the editor of the London Times,
right.
Would not be able to be a lawyer or practice this. If you're a Catholic kind of Christian, we forbid you by law hold any kind of serious office,
right,
or to take a degree at Oxford University. When the present Queen of England, Ms. Yes. Mirren, dies, at the moment of her death, here's what you have to understand. At the moment of her death, because Tim is asking a very serious question.
Yeah.
He's asking it in a humorous way, but it's a very serious question. When she dies, her slobbering, chinless dauphin of a son will become, not as the head of the state, this is what it is not to have a secular constitution.
He'll become defender of your faith.
He will become the defender of the faith, the head of the church,
yeah,
and the head of the armed forces at the moment of her death. This is what you get when you found a national church on the family values of Henry VIII.
Yeah. Well, you'll get no argument from me on that.
But it's considered by us to be. I'm no longer. I mean, yeah. But,
No, but you were an anti-monarchist.
I mean, I've been a Republican all my life, but yes, I mean, this is a Republican not just for England, but also for Ireland, for cruelly partitioned by and maimed and amputated by the British monarchy, by the forces of the crown, as you would say.
The forces of the crown.
But this is a preposterous state of affairs that no intelligent person could conceivably agree to unless it was sanctified, unless they were told, well, God wants it this way. And I know we're getting to the end of our...
We are coming, but there's two things I want
to... Don't listen to people who say that religion may not be true, but it makes people behave better.
Religion
isn't true, and it makes people behave worse and say stupid things they wouldn't say if they had senses about them.
It makes some people behave better, and makes some people behave worse. Just a couple small points, and then I was going to ask you to read something before we went to questions here.
Oh, goodness.
Just a couple small points. One in correction and one to help you out for further arguments.
Catholics
were never enjoined to eat meat, to eat fish on Friday. They were prohibited from eating meat, and so ate fish by choice. So you might there'll doubtless be another printing. You've missed your
it's a serious point.
You've also missed one of your great opportunities, since you're very fond of Tertullian.
Yes.
And I think not since a very ancient English Jesuit of my acquaintance I met anybody who quoted Tertullian quite as much as you do. But you've missed his most extreme pronunciamento, which is that any woman who swallowed semen in the course of oral sex had committed cannibalism. Now, I find it shocking that you've missed this point. I mean, it's so good. And Tertullian is, for those of you who've been spared the lectures of their right to life movement cousins, as I have not, you would find Tertullian comes up a lot in their arguments. He is a remarkably, like a lot of these guys, a remarkably unreliable guide to sexual ethics, I think, or at least I hope so. In any event,
How did he know? Don't never mind.
No. Well, you also get Aquinas just a bit wrong.
I always want to know, what were they thinking about when they wrote this? It's always good to know what they're thinking about.
They were thinking about the most extreme examples they could make in support of their arguments.
Well,
sort of what we're talking about here tonight.
Aquinas did say Aquinas did say and believe that the whole human was contained in every sperm. He thought the woman was only the bearer.
No, that's not quite right. What he said was, actually, Aquinas is quite interesting on this question, because he believed in a process called ensoulment, and that he believed, in fact, that abortion was licit until the child quickened in the womb, at which point ensoulment had occurred. Now, he did believe that male children quickened at 3 months and female children at 6. But that was another kind of problem.
Who doesn't know that?
Who doesn't know that? But what's interesting about all this, and it comes to what I'm going to ask you to read, is that Aquinas got his biology from a source at the very heart of the moral reasoning project that you now recommend. Aquinas didn't get his biology from his colleague Zigar of Brabant at the University of Paris. He didn't get it from Albertus Magnus. He got it from Aristotle. Whole, by way of somebody you and I both admire, Averroes. Something to ponder. I wonder if you'd read this. Mm-hmm. This passage, and
you want
maybe
to say anything about the previous.
Go right ahead.
Because we're trespassing on their time.
Yes,
I would simply say, Aquinas did believe that there was a whole person inside each sperm, at least in potentia.
In potentia, yes, but not because no soul.
And Alistair McGrath, who the Christians seem to now, at least the Protestants believe, is the champion, who I'm going to debate from Oxford in a few months, says that Tertullian did not say credo quia absurdum. He never actually said that.
No.
He said, borrowing from Aristotle, that there are some cases where the extreme improbability of a story makes it more likely that it's true.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as I began by saying, what's wonderful about writing a book and going out and discussing it is you refine your argument and you hope to refine others.
Is that not argument from us? That's from Aristotle, but it's from the Poetics.
Yes, but I don't think that anything that they got back from the Greeks was just returned to them. I mean, it had to come back by enormously sinuous routes from Andalusia and Baghdad.
Yeah,
to Peter Abelard, where they had for so long denied themselves the possibility.
Right.
That there could have been the Nicomachean Ethics or any other discussions of morals before Jesus Christ. How could it be that there could be any ethical knowledge before?
You remember Erasmus's great remark upon reading Socrates for the first time? When Erasmus read, he didn't have Greek, so when he finally read Socrates there in the High Renaissance in Latin, he read it and he wrote in his journal, "A pagan wrote this, and yet it has justice, truth, and mercy. I can hardly restrain myself from saying, Saint Socrates, pray for me."
Well, that's beautifully phrased. And so this will be my last word before we hand it over. I have a challenge that I've put on the Christianity Today website, which has been very kind in inviting me to debate and exchange every day of this trip, and with Douglas Wilson, who you probably know.
Mm.
I put it everywhere else. It's simply this. Any of my antagonists, and I can't wait to see how the challenge eventuates, has simply to do the following. They must, and this includes you, my dear, they must come up with a moral statement made or a moral action performed by a believer, which gives them a huge range of possibilities, that could not have been made or not have been performed by a non-believer. So, I'm not leaving until 9. And I won't leave while anyone can say I didn't answer a question. So, that's my challenge. And thank you very much for prompting me. And by the way, thank you very much for all this.
Hmm.
And what do you want me to read?
I thought maybe you could just read the start of that chapter, actually, which is quite good. And before you do, you know, I do think that you're a little light on the heavy lifting done by the great triumvirate Aquinas, Averroes, and Maimonides in reconciling faith and reason. And I would, in fact, say to you that the problem of militant Islam today really stems in large part from the different choice that Averroes, who we both admire, and whose tomb or his monument we've both gone to, we have a mutual admiration for Andalusian Spain. And you remember, Averroes dealt with the problem of Aristotle how? He said, two truths. There's the truth of revelation, there's the truth of the natural world. And the two are completely different, proceed along different courses. We need not concern ourselves with their conflict. Aquinas, Maimonides, said, no, that's intellectual suicide. Truth is unitary. It must be reconciled, no matter how imperfectly. Without that act of reconciliation, there'd be no modernism, and you and I wouldn't be here discussing this tonight.
No, but I'm with you because I agree. Stephen Jay Gould is wrong in saying these are non-overlapping magisteria. They are, in fact, antagonistic. Mm. And people should be honest enough to say that it's one or the other, and one, in an honest argument, we'll have to concede or fall.
John Scotus Erigena? John Scotus Erigena, the great Irish... theologian. He's the Carolingian.
You have the advantage of it.
Erigena, at the court of Charles the Bald, in the Carolingian court, said that truth and reason could never conflict, and that when they appeared to, it was the human duty to give the benefit of the doubt to reason, because it was our only tool of reckoning.
Well... to that extent, he conceded, and once that concession is made, I believe, as you may have found or suspected, that it's not possible to be a little bit heretical. There may even be people in this room
read.
Who...
Please read.
Now, do you want me to read the quotations as well?
You may, indeed.
Okay. Well, he wants... but I really, really feel soon we should make room for these people. Well, it's my chapter 5, which says the metaphysical claims of religion are false, a bold statement. And I front it with four quotations. One, I am a man of one book. That's Thomas Aquinas. We sacrifice the intellect to God. That's Ignatius Loyola. Reason is the devil's harlot, who can do naught but slander and harm whatever God says and does. That's, as you all know, Martin Luther. And then shifting to someone with real culture and sensitivity, and I must add, a love for Christianity, the faith from which he was excluded by his own personal desires, W.H. Auden, in a beautiful poem called The More Loving One, looking up at the stars, I know quite well that for all they care, I can go to hell.
I think that's...
How long do you want? That's it?
I think okay. That's...
Well, it's been very nice for you to be our prisoner.
And where is the person with the microphone?
Let's do it.
Okay. Shall we start on this side here? And let's go to...
Sir.
Why not? Any minute.
Thank you, Mr. Hitchens. I assume that it's your anti-faith point of view that caused you to support the war in Iraq. Is there a danger in being heretically anti-religious as fanatically for religion?
Well, your assumption is not radically, but very slightly mistaken. I mean, my view was that... Slobodan Milosevic, the Taliban, Saddam Hussein, the Rwandan genocider, the Hutu power forces, and others were eventually radically incompatible, both with the rule of law internationally and with the principles of the United States Constitution and with the values that we hold most dear, there would have to be a confrontation with them sooner or later. It didn't occur to me to present this in a religious light or a faith-based light of any kind. No. So I can't agree with the grammar of your question. That the parties of God were on the wrong side of all this, in each case, would certainly be true. And I have a long section in my book about why that's so. But I could not possibly say that I was in favor of overthrowing Milosevic or Saddam Hussein because I'm an atheist. That would be absurd, I think. Would certainly sound bizarre to me. It's just there's a radical incompatibility between totalitarian expansionist dictatorship and our survival. I wish more people realized that was so.
Someone in this section, and we'll move across. No? Here, there's a gentleman here. Sure.
Oh, did I? Was that a complete waste of my breath? All that? It's lovely to think that all that was wasted on the desert air. Gotcha. Oh, shit, now it's fallen out. I just thought I had a carrying voice. Hey.
Hi, how are you?
Too soon to tell.
Enjoy the talk.
Now can you hear me?
Yeah. Yes, thank you. I'm a believer, so I have a...
Believer in what?
Well, it doesn't matter. But
that's what I think.
We're here. So I'll take you up on that.
Look,
challenge.
I didn't plant this guy. I mean, I promise you, Daddy. I told you not to do this.
So I'll take you up on your little challenge. So my problem with the
do it briskly, if you don't mind.
Okay, sure. With the with. Your argument, as well as the atheist argument, which I'll call the objectivist argument, if that's okay.
No, it's not.
Okay, well, let's say...
I'm not a Randian.
Okay, well, according to... From what
do I look like a Randian?
When I've heard you say... No, not at all, actually.
Atlas slumped.
Right. The problem with what I hear you saying, and also what I've read in other, like in Dawkins' book, is that... the problem with denying religion in its entirety is that, to me, there's an aspect that none of us can deny, believer or not, to ourselves that's boundless, right? If someone were to knock me on the back of the head, they could take out a lung, arm, whatever, or not even touch me, and without any conscious, objective reason, I'm going to be here. I'm going to be okay. And so it seems to me that that aspect of boundless is something that we need to deal with. Science doesn't deal with it or can't deal with it yet because it's tied up with consciousness and our very being. And it seems to me that religion is the province that, however ineptly it happens, however ineptly they're doing it, deals with that aspect of boundlessness within us all and every object around us. We're all part of the universe. So how do you reconcile to that or deal with that question?
It's for me, right?
No.
Well, I can tell you, well, okay. If they keep taking those limbs and lungs away from you, by the way, it won't go on all that fantastically long. And even if they don't, and all your sound and wind and limb, as we used to say, those were, in fact, the precise words, it still won't go on that terrifically long. It just isn't. And we live on a very small planet in a very minor solar system on the very edge of a gigantic galaxy where the remainder of the planets just in our own solar system are either too fucking hot or too sodding cold to support life of any kind, as is true of very great swathes of our own planet, which is on a climatic knife edge, as we, if we didn't know before, we know now. So to say that this is the center of the universe and the whole objective of the cosmos is to produce this conversation is an extraordinarily self-centered thing to do, it seems to me. Yeah, and also doesn't, in return for its self-centeredness, which might be excused in the Randian terms, at least let's think we're gods, at least let's believe that we are the most beautifully charismatic sex maniacs who've ever appeared on any planet, doesn't yield any knowledge, doesn't help us in the least to clarify anything. No, I think we would do much better to understand our place in the cosmos. And I think if we did, we'd turn to each other with a little more respect and concern and compassion and understanding. And maybe to the people who we found are spliced into our own DNA as well, this wonderful sequencing, having abolished racism and creationism at one stroke, I regard that as a huge step forward, I must say, to understand one's kinship with all other humans, with some other animals, even with vegetables and plants. It doesn't make me feel worse, it makes me feel better. It also makes me feel I know where I am, which the other stuff simply doesn't. So I wouldn't trade that for any of your pseudo-universality, sorry.
Why don't we, here, this gentleman.
Well, thank you all very much for a very profound dialogue about what I see to be about tyranny versus human freedom in the mind and the spirit. So
we know who made his points, huh?
But both a man of faith and a man not of faith have completely slurped up the new civic myth and religion, which we've identified as GWAT, the Global War on Terror. So let's look at the myth. Right?
Is there a question?
Yes.
Please?
So this.
Okay. Question.
Being that anyone with moral and intellectual fortitude who looks at the evidence of that day sees that no Al-Qaeda jihadi had the means to schedule the war games that actually stood down
right there.
No. That's not right.
Being that any member of Al-Qaeda had no motive to anthrax the leading opponents of the Patriot Act.
Wasting your time. I'm not going to ask you.
Why won't you answer?
You can speak.
So here's the question.
You can
Being
speak.
That you are an intellectual, and now that you are an American.
Speak. I'm not bothering with you.
Why? What did,
I
do you really believe? Do
like
you really believe 19 guys with box
stop
cutters and Osama bin Laden in the cave with his Dell?
I can't make you stop, but when you stop, it's all over. Okay?
Are you going to answer me?
No, sir, I'm not.
So you believe it? Do you believe?
No, sir, I am not. No. Nor am I going to buy. I'm not going to buy a pencil from your cup either. No, I'm not. That's correct. I'm
in, way in the back there, the gentleman way in the back. Thank you.
Wow. Good evening.
That was a big wow from a small mind. Forget it. I have no time to waste on people like you.
Very, very.
What kind of person am I?
No, no, leave him alone. Leave him alone as long as he stays quiet. He had his turn. You heard his question. I'm not wasting my time on him. Next. Please.
Hi. Just a real quick question. In Sam Harris's book, The Age of Faith, he does seem to leave open the idea of either spiritual or mystical experiences on an individual level. Having just begun your book, I don't know if you're headed in that direction or... Do you part company with Sam Harris on his position on that?
No, Mr. Harris, who's a very brilliant man indeed and who knows much more about neuroscience than I do, does think that there can be consciousness independent of the brain. And we are at my, I think, very attractive, and I hope I can recommend to you exquisite magazine, Free Inquiry, having a debate. I mean, he's our newest columnist, and we're having a discussion about this very thing, about whether to be an atheist is to be a materialist or not. Sam Harris is definitely an atheist. He's some kind of a Buddhist because he doesn't think that it's a religion. And obviously, there's a case to be made for saying it isn't one. And that kind of conversation, I think, is really incredibly worth having. I mean, I do not know whether a neuroscientific breakthrough will ever discover that there could be a numinous penumbra around the brain that can't be explained by the meat of the cerebellum itself. I am certainly not going to be the one who arbitrates on this point, but I must say very skeptical about Buddhism. And I dare say you know what the Buddhist says to the hot dog vendor. You don't? He says, "Make me one with everything." Yeah, well, that's only part one, because the Buddhist then hands over a $50 bill and waits while he munches, and nothing happens. And he says to the hot dog vendor, "Okay, well, what about my change?" And the hot dog vendor says, "Change comes only from within." I myself have never heard anything more profound than that from Eastern so-called contemplation. And I told you what I thought was the atrocious and immoral line of about predestination and reincarnation that the Buddhists take on the massacre in Cambodia. And I don't like the idea of the Dalai Lama being an inherited kingship and godship. I think that's a disgusting idea. And I don't like the way that the situation of the military dictatorship in Burma is one of building entire temples in the name of Gautama Buddha. And above all, I don't like the idea that the Buddha, the Gautama, was born through a slit in his mother's side, because yet again you get it. Anything but the vagina. Disgust for females. Contempt for females. Revulsion from menstrual blood. Revulsion from the female genitalia. I personally do not regard the female genitalia in that way. I hope you don't either.
Question up here? Here, here's this lady here.
No, I didn't say email genitalia. I'm sorry. The guy, there's always someone who doesn't get it.
I have many... I'm trying to distill some of my thoughts because you evoked an enormous amount of reactions within me.
Woof.
I consider myself a traditional Jew, and I agree with everything that you have said. I also disagree with the appellations of this is a man of faith and this is not a man of faith. I mean, I think that is very unfair and absolutely very wrong to say. I don't think that Judaism quite fits into your category of religion with a capital R, because it offers you so many different parts of being Jewish. You can be an absolute atheist and be part of Judaism. You could be Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox, conservative, reform, reconstructionist, humanist, who does not want to even, I will in a moment, have the concept of God, and also be anything that you care to be, and Judaism accepts you. If some ultra-Orthodox rabbis issue statements that are not in consonance with what you have just said, then we don't have to agree with him, and we're still Jews. So this is my question.
Yeah.
When... Thank you. When Christian religionists and evangelicals say to me, but you don't understand, we have a mission for you. You need to be saved. You must accept Jesus Christ or you cannot be saved. What shall I answer them?
God, well, I mean, that's the second bit of the question is very easy to answer. I mean, tell them to fuck off. My friend Kathy Pollitt, the Southern Baptist Convention announced, they does it almost every year. This time we're really raising a real fund, they do it all the time, for the conversion of American Jews. We must bring them back to Jesus, we must save them. And Kathy Pollitt, who I've had many, many quarrels with in my life about many, many things, but who's a beautiful writer in a way, said she waited in night after night on the Upper West Side and West 88th Street, just waiting for them to come and knock on her door. She was braced. She was ready. They never came. It's a huge disappointment. Of course, the Christians can't ever be happy until the Jews do this. Because, and it's the same with the Muslims, and by the way, I apologize for slight flippancy in my first answer. Here's the situation. If the Nazarene preacher from Galilee ever really existed, there's no question who he met. He met the Jewish people first and came partly from their tradition. If the Prophet Muhammad really ever existed, I doubt both these propositions very much, but to the extent that any narrative about this can be told, the first encounter he had was with people whose first religion was Judaism. The Jews took a look at both these guys and said, no, this is not the Messiah. This is not the Redeemer. We reject them. Do you suppose they're ever going to be forgiven for it? Of course they're not. Of course they're not. The hatred for the... There isn't a Christian or a Muslim in the world of a real serious kind who wouldn't have to hope to give everything they owned for a chance of some face time with either Jesus Christ or the Prophet Muhammad. It would have to be the thing they most wanted to do. They must want it in the same way as I would like to have met Shakespeare or George Eliot. It must be the most important thing to them. And only one people, and it's the same in both cases, met their false prophets. And they both turned away and said, this isn't genuine. Do you think it's going to be forgiven? No. Do you think this has led to a huge amount of violence and turmoil and heresy hunting and fascism and genocide? Yes. Do you think it's over yet? Better not believe that. The worst is yet to come. They're never going to forgive it. That's what you get when you set Bronze Age myths in conflict with each other and let civilized people act as if they're for real.
Actually, you know, Christopher, it is possible to take exactly the opposite meaning from that example.
You think?
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the interesting things about the gospel narratives, at least in the Christian scriptures, is that if you're going to believe any part of the evidence of the gospels, there were people who heard the Son of God teach them about morality and life and said, turned around and went away. So there was there at the beginning an absence of coercion, and certainly if he was the Son of God, he could have persuaded them through what? Some force or other, but didn't. So couldn't you take a hopeful?
You know what? I think not, because I have a passage about this in my book. It's basically an attack on an Australian fascist called Mel Gibson.
Yeah.
His various demagogies, but which come from, as you know, a very theologically crazed
right,
father,
right,
but
right, right, yeah.
who wants to reverse Vatican II.
If you remember, he wanted to rip out my lungs.
Indeed, and yes. Mine too, and anyone who came into contact with...
Kill Frank
one of those people
dog.
Who shouldn't have a drink. As well.
No, never.
But his father's attack on Vatican II was a very serious and delicate one. Now, here's the situation. In his film, he tries to restore the idea of Jewish guilt for deicide, as you must have noticed. Fortunately, a lot of people didn't notice it, but okay, now the church has repudiated this.
Yes. Nostra Aetate.
Now, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but Nostra Aetate is 1968.
No, wait a minute, I'm sorry, I'm wrong about that. 60 earlier. And written by an American, by the way.
Well, I was about to say that it was fractionally earlier.
Yeah, it is a little
nearer the time of Vatican II, but.
Somebody knows?
Okay, in the 1960s. At least they're saying that.
In the Vatican Council, yeah.
I think it's 65 because I thought I had it down as 20 years after the start of the Nuremberg trial. 20 years after the start of the Nuremberg trial, the church officially says we do not hold all Jews guilty of deicide. That's quite late. Now. I'm not trying to be funny.
It moves very slowly.
I was actually trying to make you cry rather than make you laugh, but okay, giggle all you want. Why do they wait that long? Ask yourself. It's in my book. Why? Because if the story is true, which I do not believe it is, but if it is true, the only people present, definitely present, certifiably present, are the Jewish people. They were there, and he was one of them. If you say... Okay, the Jews are excused, they can go. How can you go on saying we were all present at Calvary? We were all guilty of nailing the hands and the feet. That we all spat in the face of Christ. How can you keep anyone else guilty of this if you have let go the one people who you can be reasonably sure were there? That's why they hung on so long. 2,000 years of lying and bigotry and fabrication and prejudice and pogroms every Easter and hideous representations and misrepresentations. Why couldn't they give it up? Why wouldn't it? Would it be so easy if we think of the church as yet another ecumenical thing? Well, give it up. Let the Jews go. You've let everyone go. We're not all guilty. We're not all soaked in original sin. We're not all saved by ghastly human sacrifice. We're not all implicated in this filthy cult of death. That's why it took them so long. And that's why the real believers in this myth can't let it go. And that's why I'm right, I think, in saying that religion, so far from making people behave better, has always been responsible for making them behave very much worse in barbaric, arcane, elaborate ways that no morally normal person would ever allow. And we would be better if we outgrew this barbaric cultism. And that'll have to be my last word, because it's 8:30 and it's cocktail hour. And from now on... And from now on, I can only be compassionate to anyone who has a receipt. This is America. Thank you.
Thank you, Sam.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the law firm Arendt Fox. Media support provided by KPCC 89.3 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.